We're going to call the joint meeting of the Senate and House Resources Committee to order. It is a little bit after 3. It is Wednesday, February the 25th, and we have a quorum of both sides to conduct business today. We have one item on the agenda, which is a fantastic update from the Alaska Miners Association. We're going to hear about some of the exciting mining projects that are going on across the state. But before we do that, we'll go ahead and introduce the members that are present for the record. And I am joined by my co-chairman, Senator Wilikowski, as well as Senator Huggins, Stedman, French, and Wagner. And I'll go ahead and let the co-chairman of the House Resources Committee introduce their members, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Present is myself, Representative Mark Newman, along with Craig Johnson, Representative Wilson, Edgman, Seaton, Kawasaki, and Tuck.
Okay, and so we do have both the House and the Senate members here today, and we're excited to share this with the public out there to hear what's going on. We'll start with an introduction from Steve Burrell, who is the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association. Welcome.
Is that on? Thank you, Madam Chairman. Co-chairmans and members of the committees, we very much appreciate the opportunity to come again. And what if you have an agenda there in front of you, I'm going to ask Jim Calvin of McDowell Group to come up and describe a summary of the industry, the status of the benefits of the industry that they had presented for us, and then I'll do a kind of a walkthrough of the various mines. So, Jim, you want to come up?
Thank you, Steve. Madam Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today and bring you up to speed on our ongoing effort to track the economic benefits of the mining industry in Alaska. As you know, or as you may know, we've been tracking the industry here for 4 or 5 years. In 2005, we prepared a comprehensive assessment of the economic benefits of the mining industry in the state. Since that time, we've been tracking some key indicators and publishing the results in a brochure, which is available to you. And I'm here today just to bring you up to speed on the results of our latest effort to track some key indicators that reflect the economic benefits of the mining industry to local, regional, and statewide economies. So with that, let's start with the employment picture. I guess the upshot here is that there's been no significant change in overall employment in the industry between 2007 and 2008. We're still seeing about 3,500 direct jobs. Now, this is all aspects of the mining industry, including hard rock and coal production. It includes exploration, development kinds of work. It includes industrial minerals, rock, sand, gravel, et cetera. So it's a comprehensive picture of all of the direct impacts. We still are seeing about 5,500 total jobs in Alaska that are linked in some way with the mining industry. That includes some of the indirect jobs and induced jobs. Indirect jobs are those that occur in the economy as a result of mining companies purchasing goods and services in Alaska with Alaska businesses. Induced jobs are those jobs that occur as a result of employees in the mining industry spending their payroll dollars in Alaska. So altogether, we can point to about 5,500 jobs related to the mining industry in the state, about the same number as we could see last year at this time. Payroll, total payroll is up just a bit from 07. Data through the first three quarters of 08 suggested a fairly substantial increase in payroll. However, prices started turning south towards the end of the year, and we want to reserve judgment before we say exactly what the year in total will be. But we expect some, when all said and done, some modest increase in total payroll. Again, that's a measure of direct, indirect, induced payroll. Notable about the mining industry is its average wage, which at $82,600 is about 90% higher than the average wage in the Alaska economy, and second only to the oil and gas industry in terms of average annual wage. This image really is an effort to communicate the broad geographic diversity of the economic benefits of the mining industry. Each of the dots on the map there represent a community where at least one resident is employed in the mining industry. So as you can see, there's numerous factors, 120 communities throughout the state that have a resident that's employed in the industry, all the way from Metlakatla to Barrow. Large numbers like this are the result of the fact that these mining projects often occur in very remote rural areas, which can give employment opportunities to folks in rural Alaska. The Donlin Creek project, for example, draws folks from 25 to 30 different nearby communities. Red Dog, same kind of story. And I think what's notable about this is that the jobs that the industry creates are really some of the few, if not some of the only, year-round, good-paying, well-paying private sector jobs that are available in many of these communities. Talk for a minute, a little bit about the revenues associated with mining and revenues to government in particular. The story is that not all mines are created equal in terms of their capacity to generate revenue for state government. Certainly, all operating mines are subject to a mining license tax. All mines are subject to a corporate income tax as well. Most mines pay something to local governments, whether it's a payment in lieu of taxes or a property tax, sales taxes as well, where applicable. Not all mines, however, are subject to state royalty payments. That's a function of if the project happens to be on state land. If we had Kensington to this, it would be the same situation. It would be paying a mining license tax, a corporate income tax. It would be paying property taxes in Juneau, but it wouldn't be generating royalty payments to the state. That's a function of what land the property sits on. This graph illustrates trends in terms of total revenue to state and local government in Alaska. Obviously, you can see the trend is down over the last few years. Give you a few numbers here that indicate why the trend is down. Corporate income tax, the top of the bar there, $71 million in corporate income taxes paid by the industry in 06, dropped down to $61 million in 07 and $50 million in 08. Similarly, the mining license tax was $79 million in 06 and $54 million in 07 and an estimated $45 million in 08. Royalty payments of a relatively small part of the pie overall, but have been more stable at about $7.5 million in 06 and $10 million in each of 07 and 08. Again, these are estimates. Similarly, local taxes, local revenue have been more stable at about $14, $15, $16 million over the three-year period. Total, $172 million in total revenue to state government and local government in 06, trending down to about $121 million in 08. We expect this trend to continue at least into 09. Talk for a minute about some of the specific local government impacts. I think this is what's certainly noteworthy in the numbers that we track. As I indicated, about $16 million in total local government revenues from the mining industry in 08. It includes a big chunk from Red Dog Mine to the Northwest Arctic Borough. Their payment in lieu of taxes accounts for about 75% of all general fund revenues for the Northwest Arctic Borough. Certainly the largest property tax or property tax equivalent payer in the borough. Similarly, Fort Knox mine out of Fairbanks is that area's single largest property tax payer at $2.8 million in 08. The Greens Creek mine in Juneau is Juneau's single largest property tax payer. Kensington, once online, may supplant Greens Creek in that capacity. Other areas that receive or have received significant revenue impacts from the mining industry include the city of Delta Junction, Denali Borough, city of Nome, and others. So clearly where these mines occur, they have very substantial benefits for nearby local governments. None of these numbers, by the way, I should say, include the revenue generated from property taxes on businesses that provide goods and services to the mining industry or on property taxes paid by mining industry employees, certainly in Fairbanks, for example, where most of the workforce resides, and two-thirds of whom own homes. There's additional significant property tax payments to the borough there as well. I've already given you some details on trends in mining license taxes and corporate income taxes, other revenues to the state, but I did want to point out that there are other benefits associated with the mining industry to state government or quasi-state government organizations. For example, $18.5 million in revenue flows to the railroad, Alaska Railroad Corporation, for moving coal and sand and gravel. Obviously, that creates significant economies of scale for the railroad that otherwise might mean higher costs for other users of the railroad. Similarly, ADA generates $22 million, takes in $22 million from the DeLong transportation system, supporting the Red Dog Mine and the Skagway Ore Terminal, $1.6 million in money to Alaska Mental Health Trusts, rents and royalties and the like.
And Senator Stevens has joined us.
Finally, I'd like to touch on some of the rural and native Alaskan benefits. These are the most remarkable numbers, I think, that we have been following. Red Dog paid royalties of $212 million to Nana Corporation in 2008. Now, as a result of provisions of the 7I provision of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, about 70% of those revenues are distributed to other regional corporations around Alaska, to all other regional corporations around Alaska, who then in turn distribute money to village corporations. So this is an example of very substantial revenue generation in a remote mine in northwest Alaska that pushes money through virtually every corner of the state's economy. Now, as a result of declining zinc prices were about $2 a pound 2 years ago. They're down to about 50 cents at the moment. We do expect to see these royalties decline here in the near term, perhaps somewhat more stable in terms of its economic benefit to rural Alaska and native Alaska are the employment opportunities that these projects create. For example, well over half of Red Dog's 485 employees are NANA shareholders. Even more impressive, 86% of the Donlin Creek workforce are Calista shareholders. And I think with that, I will excuse myself to the audience and turn it over to Steve, who will talk in more detail about specific projects.
Are there questions from members of the McDowell Group? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the information. I was curious on the last slide there where we're talking about the royalties paid on Red Dog. Is that the 4.5% net smelter return, and does that indicate the subtraction for the advanced monies over the previous years, or is that the gross amount of the royalties?
Well, that's the amount that is the check that's written to NANA is 212. So it's the provision, the particulars of the provision for royalties. I don't have the specifics with me, but that is, and recently they, as I understand it, much of the original capital expenditures were paid off, at which point the royalties increased pretty substantially to NANA. But this is the essentially the net royalty that flows to NANA and therefore flows and then to other Native corporations around the state.
Representative Seat.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe when we get somebody, if somebody's here with Red Dog, we can ask, or with NANA. Because I understand that the payments have been made over the years were advances and that those were then subtracted, and I'm trying to get ideas whether this includes a subtraction for the advance payments that's been made to NANA over the years, or whether this is the net in this year and the advances were left as calculated in the previous years, just so we get an estimate of what the impact is on rural Alaska communities. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Steve, did you want to have any comments on that?
Not really. I think maybe at the end of my presentation, we'd ask Carl Hahnemann to come up and address that specific point, because I don't know the details of it.
That would be great. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jim. Members, I would just I would point you to an outline here. This is the order in which we'll go through the different projects, but should have an outline in front of you. Starting with the placer mines, in 2008, we expect similar for 2009, approximately 175 operations, various others with permits in hand, production about 54,000 ounces. Those are small family mines. I think, you know, most are within less than a half a dozen people working there, but they're indeed that, families. This is you know, the historic placer mining in the state. The large operating mines, and one of the major points that that people outside of Alaska, for sure, and many inside of Alaska, they hear all the names of these projects and the companies and the press releases, and they get the picture that there's mining going on everywhere. Well, that's just not the case. And we only have five large mines in the state right now, and those are the ones on the screen, and we'll go through them in that order. But as a comparison, state of Nevada has 55 large mines, and acreage-wise, they're approximately one-fourth the size of our state. Usabelli coal mine, obviously the oldest operating of the large mines. Statistics for the mine, 110 employees, 100% Alaska hire, approximately 1.5 million tons a year, of which 1 million goes to the interior for power plants and heating, and then another, excuse me, about 500,000 tons a year to Pacific Rim destinations, and in particular, in the last couple of years, several shipments to Chile. The current reserve that the company has under permit right now that they could begin mining is about 470 million tons. This is a very interesting slide, and the co-chairs won't be able to see my pointer, but what I'd like to do is walk through this with you. This is a picture, kind of a perspective picture of Usabelli, where they're mining right now. And over on this side, you see the, of course, the actual photograph. And down here is what it looks like underground. And each of these is a cut from the drag line. So the drag line would come across, and of course, you take off the plant growth material first, and it gets set aside for future reclamation. Then the drag line sits on top of this area, and he takes that block of dirt and puts it over to the side. After that block of dirt is removed, then this amount of coal can be produced and hauled to the tipple. Once that block of coal is out of there, then these two cuts can be made with the drag line, putting the spoil over there. And there you see, that's what he's doing right now. He's making, in this case, this drag line is probably on the final cut down here, and he is sitting on this side of the pit, digging that dirt and putting it behind him over here. So anyway, that sequence just continues back and forth. And so you see it in the picture. Here's the original ground before any disturbance. Here's where the topsoil, the vegetation, trees and such have been removed, and the topsoil is removed. Here's where the mining, actually the coal, is being removed as we speak. And then you see the active pit, and here you see the various stages of reclamation, the backfilling of the pit from previous mining. Here's the grading that has already taken place, and back on this side, the grading is complete, and they've begun seeding. And again, in this picture, you see the cross-section of that. There, the topsoil's back on, or more appropriately, it's probably called plant growth material. There is very little topsoil in many parts of the state. So that's over here. But it just shows you the mining sequence. Pre-mining, the actual active mining, followed by the reclamation is across. And I thought that was an excellent description of how a strip mine works. Serious message today is this graph, these two graphs right here. In particular, the upper graph is the price of zinc over the past 5 years, and the lower one is the price of lead. And of course, where the circles are on the graph is where we are right now. And this is a huge challenge for the companies that are producing base metals of all kinds. These are just two of the base metals. We don't show copper and say nickel. But metal prices are down, bound to where they've been 5 years ago. Costs are still much higher than they were 5 years ago. And fuel, for some companies, they purchased fuel last summer to get it on site. And right now, they're burning diesel fuel that's at last summer's highest prices ever. These are some of the challenges that that some of the companies are facing right now. Greens Creek. This shows a perspective view of the of Greens Creek. Right there is the actual portal. The mining is taking place down somewhere near below Representative Newman, in perspective of the picture. But the ore is hauled here. And of course, here's the mill facility, and here's the power plant in this area, and here's the dry facility, the change house, and also the offices. But statistics, 320 employees, and they've Greens Creek has done a lot to minimize the layoffs. They have laid off five people, and we think of Greens Creek as oftentimes as a silver mine, but many years the revenue from zinc is equal to or higher than the revenue from silver. And so when zinc is at 50 cents or lower, where it had been maybe $1.20 a year ago, serious belt tightening is taking place. The other thing that Greens Creek is doing is they are doing as many of their things that contractors would normally be doing, they are doing with their own people rather than laying people off at this time. They don't expect any further layoffs. Approximately 79% of their folks are living in Alaska, largest employer, largest taxpayer in the borough, all those things. You can see the rest. Here is a, again, isometric showing the different areas, the portals being up here on this side, and then these different colors each represent a different ore type. And within those, you see the entries that have been driven down to access the different levels. That's if you looked at if you could see underground, that's part of what you would see. Here's the loadout facility where they load the ships for overseas markets. Red Dog Mine, we're looking, of course, you see the airstrip in the front right. That was paved just a few years ago, and the actual pit is off to the right, right side. And you see in the foreground, you see the, or in the middle of the picture, if you will, you see the tailings impoundment here. the biggest news at Red Dog is the need for an environmental impact statement to have a record of decision as soon as possible. That's out for public review and comment. I believe the comment period's over, and the agency, the EPA, the lead agency, is in the process of evaluating the comments. But this main pit area has been mined now since 1989 when the operation began. This line you see down through the middle, that's the diversion ditch, which is it's a culvert, so any water that falls on the hills to the left in this picture does not get contaminated in any way touching any ore or waste rock. It goes around and bypasses. And here is the new Ocklock deposit that the EIS is focused on. That will that'll last the mine another 20 years once they get the permits in place. Of course, here's the DeLong Mountain Transportation System. The two largest buildings in the Arctic are right up there, the ore storage buildings. And this past year, they ended up leaving some of the concentrate in there because the ice came early and they just didn't feel comfortable moving it to the ships. So. Some of last year's ore remains there. Here shows the lightering vessel in the picture. 485 employees, as was mentioned earlier, the different numbers. $110 million was expended to NANA joint venture companies that that had contracts because of Red Dog. Thus far, they've spent $10.8 million in searching for a natural gas source. That testing will continue this year, but not major drilling at this point. And $22.5 million paid to ADA for the use of the DeLong Mountain Transportation System. Production in 2008 was down about 10% from the previous year. And of course, payments to the Northwest Arctic Borough were down, taxes, state spending down significantly, but the numbers are still pending on what the actual payments this year to the state will be. And of course, when you see the Olympics next winter, the medals have been provided by Tech Cominco. The silver and gold price is different, and we're going to go looking at some of those operations next, but just to show what has happened over the past 10 years for gold, and it's approaching $1,000 right now. I've been told by various people that if the inflation of the early 80s had taken place when the price of gold was in the $900 range, it should be over $2,000 today from an inflation standpoint. So, and here's of course the silver price with it. That is better than the zinc and the lead. Fort Knox, Fairbanks, 450 employees plus 30 full-time contractors on site. Annual wages, benefits, payments for electricity, $15 million for fuel per year. And the significance of this number is, I can't overemphasize that, but 1.8 million man hours have been worked at Fort Knox without a lost time accident. And for those 3 years, 2006, 7, and 8, and they're approaching, I think it's in April, Lord willing, we're going to have 2 million man hours at that one operation without a lost time accident, and that is a huge, huge thing. And this is the kind of thing that companies have tremendous pride in, and that is an incredible accomplishment. Statistics at Fort Knox and their plans from 2009, approximately 330,000 ounces. The heap leach facility is under construction. They expect to begin putting ore on the heap leach in October. The phase seven of the pit began actually mining the upper benches in October of 2008. They'll continue exploring and looking for to determine if they can do a phase nine. This work, both the combination of phase seven pit expansion and the heap leach, will mean an extended life to 2014, and we're optimistic that it'll go beyond that. Pogo, underground gold mine northeast of Delta Junction. Here's a perspective picture showing the relationship of the ore body, which is underneath that ridge, and to the mine facilities. This is looking to the east, and this is what's called the Liesel 1 vein, by the way. And L2 is below it, and there might be an L3 below that. But Pogo highlights 2008. It was a year of safety improvements over 2007. Production increased from 260,000 ounces to 347,000 ounces. Employee turnover was significantly improved, and they have increased from the 250 jobs which they had a year ago to 297 at this point. Here's a shot inside the water treatment plant. The water is treated in a multi-million dollar plant before it's discharged. 2009 focus will be to minimize capital expenditures due to the economic uncertainties that we're all facing. Production slightly up at 358,000 ounces. Declining in fuel and electricity costs are definitely a positive, and the company is continuing its exploration to expand the resource base for the project. Mine's currently idle status, and let me say this is not Because of security exchange reasons, this is my term and not the company's terms, okay? To me, I know what idle means, but in no way do I mean to imply that this is, because there are certain keys for companies. If you call it something, you know, it means all kinds of ramifications to the reporting, and so that's my term, not theirs. But Nixon Fork, Rock Creek, and Kensington, all three are potentially job creators and potentially operating mines that are currently idle. Nixon Fork, just last week, the purchase was finalized between where Pacific Northwest Capital Corporation has purchased from the parent company, St. Andrew Goldfields. The work plan is being developed as we speak. They do not expect production to actually begin for another 2 years, but they're working towards that. Rock Creek at Nome operated briefly. Here you see looking at the facilities, where the coarse ore stockpile here, and it's crushed and gets the crushed material and then goes into the mill. When it's operating, they'll have 135 employees, 10.4 million payroll, 20.6 million supplies and services. And I talked to their CEO last week, and he says they are currently working on a work plan to determine exactly what they're going to do in 2009. That company, as many others, were caught with the economic downturn, and they basically had loans outstanding that they could not cover, and they had to shut down many different things and sell assets. So Kensington, north of Juneau here, north end of Berners Bay. The facilities you see are ready to go to work. The mill and crusher is complete. The 15,000-foot tunnel through the mountains complete. Underground mine workings are set up and ready to put mining machines in there on a daily basis. And the dock is ready to go. Other facilities, $230 million has been invested. And on the 12th of January, Core Alaska attorneys argued before the United States Supreme Court that they should be allowed to do a tailings approach that the district court said yes, indeed, met the law. The Ninth Circuit said no, and so it was appealed. And we're at this point, we're optimistic how the Supreme Court will come down. There's the picture within the mill. These are facilities. These are equipment that's sitting there just like that, right, as you see it right now. The lights are probably turned off to save energy, but otherwise it's ready to go. Projects in advanced exploration and permitting, the Chewett and the Coal Project by Pack Rim Coal, followed by, we talked about Donlin Creek and Pebble. Chewett and the Coal is in the process of finalizing a supplemental environmental impact statement. 15 years or so ago, the company had a record of decision. They had their permits in hand. They were ready to build the mine, but by the time they got that, the price of coal had decreased sufficiently that it wasn't economic. They are now looking at an investment to project over $600 million, 350 full-time employees for a capacity mine of about 12 million metric tons per year design capacity. The infrastructure, it'll have a, depending on the exact routing of the conveyor and the road and power line and everything, 9 to 12 miles of road and conveyor, personnel housing and an airstrip there, LAD landing, logistics center, etc. And in the picture you see over at the lower right-hand corner, it's approximately a 10,000-foot trestle out into deep enough water to allow a 60-foot draft vessel, in other words, a Cape-class vessel that could go around the Cape of South America. They're optimistic that they'll have their record of decision here this fall and anticipate approval somewhere into 2010. Donlin Creek, of course, the camp site out there with the Airsfield off to the left. 2008, they completed just over 33,000 meters of drilling, 138 employees from 26 villages at this point. Advanced project engineering and baseline environmental studies have continued. And in 2009, the finalize the feasibility studies, submit the permits, the application for the project, and the company has already had pre-permitting meetings with 35 of the villages so far. I believe they have like 55 villages out there to visit, and they're going to meet with the rest of those here in the month of March, and then make the submittal. Here's a picture. This was the project puts out a newsletter to the local community, and this is a picture of the villages that have had people working at the site. 23 villages represented in 35 in 2007, and 2008 it was 26. Pebble project. Several important things have happened in 2008. John Shively, whom you probably all of you know possibly better than I do, is now the CEO for the Pebble Partnership, and I believe that's an extremely positive positive move on the company's part. Last year, right at $140 million was spent. That's nearly twice as much as has been spent in any previous year. More than 800 people employed, 200 holes drilled, and an incredible amount of environmental and pre-feasibility work ongoing. 2009, the partners are involved in various base metal projects around the world, and base metals are way low in price. We mentioned zinc, but copper's low also in price, and so the budget is not yet established. They expect some drilling this year. They will continue working on a pre-feasibility study and environmental baseline studies project. Here shows a map of the area, of course, with Lake Iliamna here on the project site, just north of there. But major challenges, of course, the source of power and road, port, power, mill. All major issues for the project, the permit process, workforce development, to train local people for the jobs to the maximum extent possible, and of course commodity prices and the actual economics of the project obviously are what are going to drive the project. Grassroots, so we'll say early stage exploration, actually there last year McDowell study, of course, pointed out there were 30 projects that spent more than $1 million each. Some of those could have been same company at two or three locations, but that many projects that spent over $1 million each in Alaska. We expect fewer of those in 2009. What the number will be, I'll tell you next year, but clearly the focus is going to be on gold in 2009. Base metal projects will have a very difficult time getting funding, exploration projects. And three of the examples I'd like to touch on will be International Tower Hill at Livengood, Niblack, and then Lucky Shot. This is a kind of a picture with an overlay of some drilling areas of International Tower Hill's project. It's called Money Knob up at Livengood. You see the Elliott Highway coming by right along here, headed to the North Slope. And within this area, they are right now, as we speak, they have drills on these green circled areas. These are extremely wet areas, wetland areas that they have to drill during the winter when there'd be no damage to the countryside. And so they're on top of the frozen ice or snow drilling down. This shows the previous drilling that has taken place, and then this brownish area is where they expect to be drilling this year. In 2008, on the right side of the slide, you see the phase one and phase two drilling that was completed. Phase three is what they're working on right now. Phase four will be the more, if you will, uplands and the brown drilling in 2009. In 2009, they are projecting 8.5 million expenditure as compared to 8 million in 2008. Approximately 45 employees, up slightly from 2008. And then other projects around the state, they expect to spend about another $1.5 million. In Southeast Alaska, the Niblack property, and of course you see the map here shows the relationship to Ketchikan. This property is a historic mining site at this location. And then there are two other areas that they have. The same company has mining claims, but in that this is a base metal site for primarily base metals, it will be more difficult for them. But in 2008, they completed an underground adit approximately 5,000 feet into the mountain. They completed a phase one drilling, and in 2009, they right as we speak, they're on care and maintenance, but they expect a budget of $3.6 million and 7,000 plus meters of drilling, and of course the continued environmental impact studies and such. But that's a it's an aerial view of the anchorage right there at Niblack. Full Metal Minerals. I would contrast the two sides of the slide to you. In 2008. They had 11 project areas that they worked on at some length, five drill programs, spent $21 million, and in 2009, indicative of the changes in 2008, the 40 Mile, for example, which is a base metal silver property, primarily, I believe, on Doyon-owned lands. That was a major focus as a year ago right now, but after the commodity price crash, they can't raise money for that work, but they do expect to work at Lucky Shot. They're looking, and Lucky Shot is on Willow Creek, between if you went to Hatcher Pass and you came up to the ski area and you went west across the top, you would come past Lucky Shot. It's on an established road. It's a historic mine area, and they expect to do a 10,000 ton bulk sample. They've budgeted $7.5 million, and they're looking at 25 to 40 workers. The previous mill back from what, 20 plus years ago is still there in place, and so that's where they would be processing the bulk sample, and they're in the process of their permitting. With that, open for questions from myself or for others. All of the large mines on the list have representatives here from those companies. If I don't know the answer, they would be very willing to try to answer your questions. And I know some of the projects do not have representatives here, but thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burrell. So why don't we start with the question for Red Dog that Representative Seaton asked earlier on the record. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Carl Hahnemann, Director of Corporate Affairs for Teck. We're operator of the Red Dog and the Pogo Mines. And Representative Seaton, through the chair, in response to your question, maybe for others that maybe are less familiar, stepping back a little bit with respect to the Red Dog ore body and the agreement between Teck and NANA. Of course, after the original discovery in the late 70s, the ore body was drilled off and it was identified as the world-class number one zinc deposit in the world, essentially both in terms of grade and in total size. And so through the ANCSA process, NANA was selected that land and then sought a operator and a partner for that. And they basically then had a world-class ore body identified, and through the negotiated a partnership agreement with Cominco, which was we've since merged, and Teck Cominco is now known as Teck. So it's a very different circumstance than one would normally have in terms of the royalty structure and what you specifically referred to as this provision where you converted from a net smelter return royalty to what now is a very substantive 25% net profits interest royalty to NANA. And so they negotiated that early on, but after the ore body had been fully identified. And the numbers that the McDowell Group presented are estimates based on, you know, before year-end numbers, but they're essentially correct. And those do, in fact, reflect the 2008 recoupment of all the prior advance royalties and the conversion to the net profits interest. And the structure of that agreement was such that it provided for a advance royalty to NANA during the period of time where capital was to be recouped. And, of course, production started in 1989, and it took until the fourth quarter of 2007, you know, essentially 18 and a half years later, to actually recoup the original investment plus the fees and interest associated with that. But so those numbers do reflect the actual payments made in 2008, subject to the year-end you know, adjustments based on the estimates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was the answer. I was trying to just figure out the how to balance that with earlier reports.
Complex. Okay. Other questions, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, does Full Metal, thank you, Madam Chair, does Full Metal have a representative here,
Steve? They do not, sir.
Yeah, just a couple of comments and a question for you. Number one, thank you for the update on Lucky Shot, because my concern was that they were not going to be in operation in 2009, but good news, and thank you for that. And, you know, I can tell you from some of my neighbors and having gone to some of the community council meetings, there are people thankful for the prospects of Lucky Shot, and obviously that's in a historical mining district, and people look for the activity, but merchants, not just the people that work there, get the bonus of people shopping and living and things of that nature, and I say thanks to you. Now, but do you have, Steve, in Lucky Shot's case, I'm not sure what phase this would be called, but if we went forward with 2010-11, any projection about the maturation of that and production, just from a professional opinion, for lack of a better term?
Senator, through chair, my sense is that the bulk sample will tell them what they, if they need to make changes to the mill process, to the and it allows them the time to continue their permitting. Can they get the permits in place for say a 2010? I don't know that for sure. But if indeed they find from the bulk sample that everything is positive, I know they want to move as fast as they can, and that'll be their desire. But now, can it happen into 2010? I wouldn't want to guess that. But the uncertainties of trying to permit a project are so huge, and you don't know, is somebody going to decide they want to challenge it legally, and then, of course, the legal system kicks in. So,
Senator Huggins.
And just a general follow-up, you know, as I read minor accounts and emails and what have you, it appears to me that somebody that wants to get into the mining business, this is not the right time to do it. And if you look at stock prices for mining organizations, commodity prices, operating costs, and I mean, you name it, it is a tough business. But could you just give us about a 30-second burst on what that really means, or if I'm correct or incorrect, and what the right story is?
Senator, through the chair, you are correct. It's one tough business. We looked for a set of zinc prices that would say start from the start of Red Dog, or when the Red Dog and Greens Creek made their start decision. And indeed, it is only, as Carl just mentioned, it was only in 2006 that Red Dog recouped its costs from building that mine, you know, how many, 19 years ago or whatever. And it is a tough business, and the companies, thank goodness they can hold on at the times when things are tough, and they've they've been able to do that. The five that you see there have been able to do that. It is indeed tough. Is it a bad time to get into mining? I don't think so. I mean, I guess we're all too much of an optimist to say that, because opportunities in Alaska are tremendous. The overall long-term demand for metals is there. We have China and India that are just. We have people that have been in effectively a third world kind of a lifestyle that all of a sudden have a little bit of extra money, and that extra money, they use it in two ways. One way is to improve their lifestyle by getting running water in their house, maybe, and that means copper pipes or electrical energy, you know, to have a light on in the house where they've never had electricity before. Those are factors. And the other thing they do is they buy some gold, because they don't necessarily trust their government, and they look at thousands of years of history and they say that my grandparents and their grandparents, they all would keep a little bit of gold on hand for the, you know, for protection against the future and unknowns. So I think the opportunities are here are great.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I was wondering if there's anybody here that could comment on Will Wywoski. It's a potential mine site south of Wrangell-Darrells.
Senator, through the chair, I don't know that for certain that they're going to have a drilling program, but they hope to. Their plan, and the Wywoski Island is northwest of Wrangell. It's an island that the trees aren't very good on it because of all the mineralization in the rocks, basically. And a local company called Olympic Resource Group has been exploring it for many years. They have a company that has leased it from them called Bravo Ventures, and they expect to put a couple holes in a particular area. And will they be able to do that in the current economic situation? I don't think they're sure yet. They very much want to, and that's their goal, and they're working hard towards that. But will they get it done this year? I don't know. I hope they will. I think there's better than 50% chance that they will.
Excellent. Further questions from the committee? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Steve, you know, we heard on public reports recently about the large claims by Yakutat, those black sand ridges and all. Is there any development there? I know most of it's on Forest Service land, some of it's on state land. Is there any prospect of development there, or is it just future anticipation?
Representative Zeaton, through the chair, I know that they're planned to have a work program again this summer. What the opportunities are, what they're going to do longer term at this point, I don't know. I know that iron prices have gone down significantly, as other base metals have, and so if they have to raise money through the stock exchanges, they will not be able to at this point. Now, what exactly their plans are, I'm not sure.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Stephen, I'd like to see if you could shed some insight on the financing for some of our mines, you know, realizing that a lot of these mines, most of these mines, are in very depressed regions of our state. What's the state doing, do you think? Are we doing enough to provide some economies or some borrowing opportunities? You know, what is ADA doing? You know, with Rock Creek, you mentioned that they're closing their doors or selling off things because of the hard economic times that we're all facing right now. Is there a way that loans can be refinanced, or what opportunities are out there for industry to make sure that we don't close down mines, that we provide jobs and economic engines in our state?
Representative Newman, through the chair, if it sounded what I said, that Rock Creek is shutting down, selling off, they've shut down operations, but they're not looking to sell off, to my knowledge, the property. they are looking to sell other assets that the company has elsewhere. But I sure don't think they're looking to sell the Rock Creek. Should the state be in the loan business? I won't speak for AMA, but for myself, I don't think so. I think this needs to be. They need to be in the markets with other capital needs. Many years ago, there was a mining loan program. This was over 20 years ago now. That basically, my opinion was a failure. Many individuals got loans, and I believe the projects need to meet the tests that the financial community has. And I know today is an oddity in financing, but I can't advise that. Now, from an ADA standpoint, that's very different. ADA turns out to be a guaranteed loan by the state. The Red Dog facilities, for example, the Long Mountain Transportation System, the agreement with that property was that that the company would continue to make a minimum payment even if they had to shut down at some point. And of course they've paid more than double the original price of those facilities at this point. So that was a tremendous benefit to the state through ADA in that case. Those are the kinds of loans. I know that the Skagway ore facility is receiving concentrates from mines in Canada now. That's a great opportunity for the state and for ADA to come in and do that kind of a thing. I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I was more concerned of what ADA is doing to assist in our mines and make sure that they're available. So, Madam Chair, maybe if we could get a report from ADA on what they're doing to help supplement our mines. Thank you.
Absolutely. We'll follow up on that. Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Steve, the roast resources was a term that was used in the past administration, and there was some money allocated. And I think there's some money sitting someplace still in the pot, the residue of that. But are there any of the mines that you talked about today that benefited from the approach of roads to resources? And
Senator, through the chair, Rock Creek, by building a 3-mile road, Rock Creek, from the Teller Highway straight north, they were able to bypass an existing road that I'm going to guess was about 9 miles long that came up and circled around. And that 3-mile road, to my knowledge, was the only road that actually got built in the Roads to Resources program. I know that the Department of Transportation has a request out right now for, and I don't know how much, if they have money left or how much, but they have a request out right now asking that very question for people to say, hey, do you have something specifically? It turns out that by far in most cases, and this is throughout history, the mines have produced, have developed, and they have paid for their own infrastructure, their own roads, their own power plants. These lights are run by, you know, the power plants here that some were built, 97 years ago, and they're still running, and that's why Juneau has its lowest electrical price in the state is because of the power plants that the mines built and then became, you know, city property afterwards.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And Steve hit at one of the points that I was going to make in this community, and you pointed out it better than I could articulate it, but it is one of the key elements that we all have to be reminded of sometimes, that a large mine is like a small town in the sense that it has the full infrastructure, and we're not going to move the minerals, but wherever they happen to be, if they're close to a village in particular or some existing inhabitation, it may in fact be the only job source that will be available or has ever been available. And it is one of the, we're not going to build Walmarts in these locations, and we're not going to, you know, have other kinds of activities, but the natural activity is resource development. And we have to be reminded in our state that it is the way to put people to work in a lot of cases when nothing else is available. Thank you.
Absolutely. A couple questions for you, Steve. To what extent, and you may or may not know the answer, but in the mines, have folks talked about using different forms of energy, lower cost forms of energy, such as wind and biomass and things like that out in these mines? You talked a lot about diesel and having made those purchases when the price was so high. And I'm just curious, we've had a lot of conversations in this building, this session, about alternative energy and potential to lower operational costs for businesses. And I'm just curious what those efforts might
be. Sure, Madam Chairman. What each of the companies has necessarily done, I'm not certain. However, I know that every one of them is looking very hard, and the further they get from the rail belt, the harder they look for alternative energy sources. I know that that Donlin Creek has looked at biomass. Yes, they've looked at wind generation and different things. What the conclusions have been, that I don't know. Representatives are here if you want to ask them that specific question. But no, companies absolutely have looked at that. I mentioned on the slide, the one Red Dog slide, there was $10.8 million that Red Dog has spent over the last several years looking for shale gas, basically. I said natural gas on there, but basically it's gas within the shale out there. And if they can find a local gas source, all of a sudden they could be generating their power using that gas rather than bringing in diesel fuel. So tremendous potential benefit. The city at Nome, I believe it's Sipnisok Corporation, has just completed, I'm not sure the number, 25 or 30 wind towers above Nome. When you go to Nome now, you'll see them off to the northeast. And companies are very interested in finding things that are economically make sense to cut their electrical costs, no question.
Well, and on that point, we will be continue to hear about it. As Senator Huggins just pointed out, often a mine, particularly in far out and removed communities, can be the impetus for a lot of things. And when you talk about shale or you talk about wind, the potential to then generate energy that can be used by folks in the village, mm-hmm. Is a real exciting prospect. And I just wanted to point out, we have a Senate Bill 31, which puts in place a production tax credit for capital investments in alternative energy projects. And right away, my mind starts thinking about how that could be used as a creative financing mechanism to sort of get some of these mines.
Madam Chair, my sense is that the real gorilla that could help the price of energy, the price of electricity, more than anything else, is coal. Mm-hmm. We have so much coal in this state, and as the Usabelli slide showed, they have 470 million tons that's already under permit. I mean, they have the permits in place to quadruple their production immediately, and that part of the reason that during the most recent energy crisis that the Fairbanks area everyone was hurt, but Fairbanks would have been hurt so much worse if such a large percentage of their power had not been coal. It was coal. The prices are stable. They increase somewhat at times, but that is by far the most stable. It's not tied to the price of oil or gas in Indonesia or China or anywhere else. It's right here local, and we have control over it.
And then two other questions. Speaking of coal, I was speaking with some friends of mine from the Northwest Territories a few days ago, and they were talking about diamonds and what they are discovering in new diamond deposits, and of course the extra value added, if you will, from being from that unique part of the world and how they're able to market it. Harry Winston is out there, that jewelry designer, pulling in a bunch of diamonds. And my question is anybody looking at diamonds, and have they talked to you about it?
Madam Chair, if people are looking for diamonds, they don't talk to anybody about it. Okay, having said that, yes, there has been some diamond exploration in the state. I believe the number is like 6 diamonds have been found in the Circle Mining District, northeast of Fairbanks. These were found by the placer miners, and this is over, I don't know, probably over a 40 or 50 year period. But I've seen one of them. It's you know, it's the end of your finger. So there somewhere there is a diamond source. But how far did it go? The fellows in Northwest Territories that discovered the current diamond mining area, they followed the indicator minerals 300 kilometers across Canada to find where the source was. And where is the source for the ones that have been found in the Circle District? I don't know.
Yeah, it's just an interesting thing to think of in terms of future economic development. It's certainly, as you know, a big source of economic development and jobs in Yellowknife. And then my last question is, our friends in Canada do seem to have a more robust mining program. They do seem to bring in more mines. And my curiosity about, you were in my office and we were talking about many of the mines in 89, really that kind of being, there were some earlier, but really 89 being the kickoff point of big mine development. And so here we are in 2009. Where would you say Alaska falls in terms of incentivizing mining, and could you compare it to our Canadian neighbors?
Madam Chairman, my sense is the biggest factor of all is something the state of Alaska does not control, and that's the NEPA process, National Environmental Policy Act. The NEPA process requires for all projects that require a federal permit and an environmental assessment if it's on federal lands. If you require 2 or more federal permits, i.e. if you need a discharge permit from EPA and you need a wetlands permit from the Corps of Engineers, you're forced into an environmental impact statement, a full EIS. For the Pogo mine, for example, it took 3.5 years to go through the EIS process. The final document was, it's a huge document. And if it was just the matter of studying it and understanding what's the best alternative for these things and going forward, that's an engineering challenge, if you will, okay? But the real challenge is the number of places at which those that want to block you and stop you have avenues, legal avenues to do that. To me, that is the that is a curse this country carries on any resource development project. And it's not just in Alaska, but it's everywhere. There is such a there are so many opportunities for legal challenge on some of the most minuscule little reasons. And the judges have to defer, and then they go through the courts. The Kensington one is a prime example. We are missing over 100 jobs right now in this community at Kensington because of a lawsuit. The district court said, yes, the Corps of Engineers and EPA have done the right thing. They've done it just fine, but the lawsuit was challenged. It went to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit overturned, and now it's in the Supreme Court. That's the kind of thing, and that has a huge negative impact on anyone in this country that wants to do a mineral project. I don't think there's any easy answer.
Thank you for that. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question that follows up what Senator Stedman asked. On Rokowski Island, I want to go to a little bit closer to Randall on Zarambo, and I think they're behind time on the other one. But do you know how are they proceeding? What's happening there at all?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, they continue to do. They did some. They had a small, literally, I think you'd call it a backpack drill. It's the kind of thing guys could carry on their either their back or on a four wheeler. They did some drilling last year. They had positive results. It, what they need to find is they need to find somebody that has a lot more money that can come now and do additional drilling. And I would presume they're looking for that. I have talked to them. They haven't mentioned that they're going to be doing any further at this point on Zarumbo Island. But I know they're very, you know, they're very keen on it. They believe that there's something there they need to keep looking for. But I don't know of any plans they have for this summer.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that members of the large mine permitting team have expressed interest in regulations or policy that would require sharing of field data with them as things go forward on a very timely manner. And I know that we receive that data confidentially by the agencies in oil and gas, and I'm not meaning that this that a mining permit is the same as a lease on oil and gas. But has the industry taken any position on the sharing of that data, either on the field data, whether it's the environmental data or whether it's exploratory data with the agencies as things go forward?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the Investment Incentive Act that was passed maybe 15 years ago now requires that a company share that data. I mean, we're not talking environmental, we're talking about the resource data, the geologic data, and there's a very specific list of requirements that the company has to turn in under that program. And they turn those in, you know, at the time they want to, if they want to claim the investment incentive. Beyond that, we've not talked about that for quite a while.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Seaton.
And on the environmental field work, that data, is there a sharing of that data with the large mine permitting folks at the time that's being generated, or does that all wait for a final report, or does the industry have kind of a consolidated a policy or opinion on that?
Mr. Seaton, through the chair, the immediate thing that comes to my mind is that until you have a track record of data, any one data point can be taken out of context. And we've not talked about environmental data in that way. It does indeed get to the large mine permit team. I mean, reams of material, far more than any of us would want to spend the time reading. But that data does get to them at an early stage. I don't know that the companies would keep it from the large mine permit team, but it clearly is not appropriate to publish it before the company is ready to publish it. And there are groups and individuals out there that would love nothing more than to take a small snapshot of a limited data source and use that to say, well, look at this terrible thing here, and without seeing the context, the entire context. And so I would be very concerned about anything that would make that kind of a requirement put on the industry, because be it for oil and gas or mining, either one, until you can see the overall picture, you don't know what the result is going to be. You don't know what the design is going to be. That's one of the reasons you collect that data, to know what does our engineering design have to look like to meet the regulations and meet the statutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, anything further? Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
With that, we're adjourned.